Today in Studio 360, it looks like black and white movies are having a comeback. So how come?
When you don't shoot in color, you don't have to worry about color.
We'll hear from today's pioneers of black and white film, including the actress Greta Gerwig.
When you see something in black and white, there's something about it that's instantly like, it's about cinema.
And the director Alexander Payne, whose new movie Nebraska perfectly captures the Great Plains landscape without color.
I felt that this story would be most meaningful and most beautiful with leafless trees, overcast skies, and stubbly cornfields.
I'll talk with Payne as well as the film's stars, Bruce Dern and Will Forte. Plus, a look back at Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Jazz to Come, an album that really did change the shape of jazz. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The filmmaker Alexander Payne is among our best, but so far, not among the most prolific.
I'm 52 right now. I've only made 6 films. They're fine, but, I'd like to think that they're minor works and that I've got some good stuff coming up ahead.
The director Alexander Payne's coming up. We'll talk about his new movie Nebraska, which is part of a 2013 trend. Big deal black and white feature films.
By this hand, I love thee.
Earlier this year, there was Joss Whedon's modern adaptation of Much Ado About Nothing and Noah Baumbach's Frances Ha about 20-something self-discovery.
You know, I found something out about Walden's Pond. It was 5 minutes from his mom's house. He used to go over there and get supplies.
Although Payne's movie has the biggest budget of the bunch, it's still modest at about $14 million. Studio 360's Julia Lowry Henderson talked with film scholars and filmmakers about this black and white renaissance.
You know, the last couple of months, we've seen many more black and white films, and many people are saying, oh, this is this big new trend. But you know, the black and white film has really never gone away.
That's Bob Thompson. He's a professor of popular culture at Syracuse University.
Every decade, we've had not only filmmakers making films in black and white, but really good filmmakers making some really good films in black and white.
There are the heavy films like Elephant Man and Raging Bull. There are nostalgic movies like Paper Moon and Stardust Memories.
And for one brief moment, everything just seemed to come together perfectly, and I felt happy.
There are period movies like Schindler's List and The Artist. And of course, there is...
My name, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
When you see something in black and white, you remember movies. There's something about it that's instantly like... It's about cinema.
Greta Gerwig co-wrote and starred in one of this year's crop of black and white movies, Frances Ha.
I've always liked black and white because it's not verisimilitude to life. You're clearly showing an image that was captured. We're presenting this to you, and there's a remove. You know that this is not the world. This is film.
All right, Frances. We are going to take over the world.
You'll be this awesomely bitchy publishing mogul.
And you'll be this famous modern dancer, and I'll publish a really expensive book about you.
The D-bags we make fun of will put on their coffee tables.
And we'll co-own a vacation apartment in Paris.
And we'll have lovers.
And no children.
And we'll speak at college graduations.
And honorary degrees.
So many honorary degrees. It's a movie about youth as it passes you, and there's something instantly backwards looking about it. You're already looking in the rearview mirror. It's already receding, and the black and white seem to work with that.
The director of photography on Frances Ha was Sam Levy.
When Noah Baumbach contacted me to shoot Frances Ha, he described wanting to make a movie somewhat in the production style of the French New Wave as we understand it, as people who weren't actually there.
Oui, le français.
That kind of youthful, off-the-cuff feeling of the French New Wave is something Joss Whedon was also going for in Much Ado About Nothing. Jay Hunter was the cinematographer for that film.
My mission on Much Ado was to make it more like a French New Wave film, but I think in the end it sort of feels more like a Fellini film or something than anything, or like a Bergman Fellini type of thing, if I'm lucky.
That all sounds very artsy, but these directors aren't all trying to make art films. Randy Moore shot his fantasy psychological horror movie Escape from Tomorrow at Disneyland without telling anybody at Disney.
In terms of the Disney movie, basically it's DIY filmmaking with hidden camera. It's guerrilla filmmaking without any permission.
That's Professor Carl Bardosh. He teaches a class on cell phone cinema at New York University's film school. According to Bardosh, Escape had to be in black and white.
If you show Disneyland in color, it's too close to how Disneyland is presented in color in other films. If you put it in black and white, it's already a nightmarish vision.
In contrast, Alexander Payne's use of black and white in Nebraska recalls a 1950s America.
A father and son road trip, it's kind of evokes this nostalgia, this American life that doesn't exist anymore.
It looks like he painted with gray. There's something luminous about it.
But let's face it, if in the 21st century you choose to make a film in black and white, you are making a statement.
For a filmmaker, making a black and white movie is like going to Walden Pond, deliberately withdrawing from Hollywood studios, their money, their expectations.
The reality of making a black and white film is someone might buy it to distribute it after it was made, but no one would tell you to go make a black and white movie with their money.
Joss Whedon paid for Much Ado out of his pocket, and Frances Ha was made so cheaply and quietly, no one even knew they were doing it.
There's just more opportunities to do stuff like that now, whereas, like, I feel like Cassavetes was, like, selling his car for film stock.
Now, let's be honest. None of these filmmakers are selling any cars for any film stock, because they're not really shooting in black and white.
The way you do it now is you shoot digitally, you shoot in color, and then you extract the color later in post-production.
Which does make it easier to shoot your movie, especially if you're on a budget.
You know, when you don't shoot in color, you don't have to worry about color, which can, you know, concern nearly every department on a film shoot.
I think one real disadvantage of lower budget filmmaking is a lack of control that you have over palettes, because very often you're shooting in the world and that's an orange wall and you can't do anything about it.
Look at that awning that's like 20 blocks away that we can't change.
Still, it's not just about doing black and white to save money. There's something else at play here. The number of people who saw the old black and white movies in the theaters or who bought black and white TV sets is shrinking over time. And so the number of people for whom black and white is something new is growing.
When I started teaching back in the early 1980s, if I would have encountered an average 20-year-old student and wanted them to watch a black and white film, most of them would have balked at it. A 20-year-old in the 21st century is a whole different case entirely. Today, black and white, in many ways, is the new avant-garde.
And that's because all photography has gone digital.
The 20-year-old today has been messing around with images on their laptops, their cell phones, their pads.
I go on Instagram, and I can put a filter on a picture of my friends at lunch, and it looks like we're at a restaurant in 1948. Or I can fade the color so it looks like it's a photo from 1972.
It means that finally now we arrived in an era where the language of film is now really becoming widespread. With mobile, practically everybody will be educated to understand the filmmaking process.
I remember watching Frances Ha at Telluride with my girlfriend, Sasha, and the film came up, and I turned to her, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be our competition. It's another black and white movie. And I had no idea there were going to be like five other black and white movies in 2013. So they weren't really our competition. We were just part of a movement.
For Studio 360, I'm Julia Lowry Henderson.
Don't throw past away. You might need it some rainy day. Dreams can come true again when everything old is new again.
You can see a slideshow in black and white of the movies mentioned in our story at studio360.org.
Be a movie star.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska.
That's right. To get my $1 million.
This black and white movement is a quintessentially indie affair. Movies with smaller budgets, smaller stars, smaller audiences. The biggest and most anticipated of all this year's black and white films is Alexander Payne's Nebraska, which is now opening across the country. It's about a discontented father who sets out on a road trip from Montana to his home state of Nebraska in pursuit of imagined sweepstakes winnings, driven there by his discontented son.
How much longer is he going to be around? What's the harm in letting him have his little fantasy for just a couple more days?
Like me, Alexander Payne's home state is Nebraska, and he still lives there half the time. I recently sat down with Payne and the film's stars, Will Forte, Bruce Dern, and June Squibb, to talk about the movie and their careers. We spoke at an event organized by Filmstreams, a great nonprofit cinema in, where else? Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Alexander.
Good evening, Kurt.
You chose to film this time of year, and early December, the time when the Nebraska landscape is its least obviously glorious and beautiful.
You know, the screenplay suggested it, suggested a certain deadpan austerity, and I just felt that this story would be most meaningful and most beautiful, quite frankly, with leafless trees. And in the movie, you see forever the skeletons of trees and overcast skies with beautiful puffy clouds and stubbly cornfields. That's just the look I wanted.
Yeah. Plus black and white. Which, of course, people talk about because there aren't very many big Hollywood movies done in black and white today, although there seems to be a bit of a renaissance. You told me you had to do what you described as a year of horse trading with your studio to get them to agree to that. What was your end of the horse? What did you give up to get that? What was your end?
More money with which to make the film. It all comes down to dough. So they think, I'm saying the obvious, that a black and white movie can ghettoize a film into seeming too artsy-fartsy and fewer people see it in theaters. And then later, concretely, they can point to TV deals they have around the world, and those contracts stipulate color only. So they say, well, you know, we're leaving a lot of money on the table. And I said, well, that's why I'm coming to you with a cheapie. The budget ended up being about $13.5 million, and I know had it been in color, it would have been about $16.5 million. And at that budget range, each million makes a big difference.
When the studio said we have to sell it to Uzbekistan in color for their TV, you said, okay, I'll make a color version because
you bet.
It's you shot it in digital, so that's not impossible.
And I did make a color version. I've seen it once quickly and fast forward.
What? Which is...
And it's actually pretty beautiful. I mean, the film is well shot. And the color we gave it looks like a 1971 film. It was a nice educational experience for me, but it's not appropriate for this film. But
right. You say it's not as good a film.
No.
Just because the whole thing was meant to be in black and white, you designed it for black and white?
Yes.
You are a very deliberative person, it seems. You don't act rashly. You had this script for almost a decade before you got around to making it. What is the value to you of sitting around and thinking about things for a while? Do you regard that as part of your filmmaking process?
Well, film is so large an undertaking. Even small films are large undertakings, and they need to be well thought out and well planned, beginning with the screenplay. Everything stems from the screenplay. The interest of financiers, the interest of actors, what you're going to shoot, how you're going to be in the editing, everything stems from the screenplay. And so you end up spending a lot of time thinking about it.
And the other thing, it seems to me, that one needs to do well is cast, which you also spend a lot of time doing.
More than other directors. The screenplay, the most important thing is casting.
And casting, in the case of Nebraska, as well as other films you've made, but especially Nebraska, non-professional actors.
There's talent everywhere. And in fact, a beautiful part of our job is finding people who have no idea that they could be good actors. Nor do they have the interest in being in acting. But we say, you know, you could do this, and come do it. And you see them in the film.
And is there, give me an example in Nebraska of what a not, other than, oh, these people seem very real because they are there particular moments that you get out of a non-professional that are memorable and great and makes you keep doing it in other films?
A sense of authenticity, faces and accents. For example, there's a lady, her name is Eula Freudenberg. She plays Jean Westendorf in the film. And her husband is a retired farmer from I forget which town. And the line of dialogue is, "Are you still doing hair out there, Kate?" Which she had presumably practiced and practiced, but when we went to shoot, it came out, "Are you still fixing hair out there, Kate?" Which I loved, which is more accurate in the way she said it, and that's what I'm trying to get.
So, of your six films, it is amazing, again, in this day and age especially, that there is so little bordering on no significant violence or death. As you look at them, do you think, oh, that's just because that doesn't interest me, or that's a cheap way out of a screenwriting problem? I mean, the films, as we know, have gotten more and more violent these last 30 years, while yours are pacific.
I have to answer that question with another question, which is, why do all movies have to have violence and death in them? So, and thank you. But I just get bored with it as a form. I mean, I'd like to make a Western one day, and that, you know, presumably would have a shooting or something like that. Not like, you know, and I watch violent. I like old samurai movies and Westerns and stuff. But I make comedies.
Looking at your films, thinking about the dozen major characters in them, except maybe for George Clooney in Descendants, except probably for Reese Witherspoon in Election, they could all be described as losers of one kind or another. Is that what interests you?
I don't think of them that way.
You wouldn't.
And if I did, if I accepted your observation and said, oh, I tend toward protagonists who are flawed or blind in some way, or there's a discrepancy between who they think they are and who they really are. And that's actually one technique. That's one reason why I like voiceover, because they can tell you what they think about themselves and then you see something else. So, but if that's true, I would say it's a comic archetype. Chaplin had the tramp, Keaton had the great stone face, and Laurel and Hardy had those, you know, the good-natured buffoons. And somehow, and I would say this is something derived at with my co-writer, Jim Taylor, somehow we tend toward this, I can't use the word loser.
I understand.
But these,
I said some would say that.
These individuals.
We will continue talking. You will stay here on the couch, Tonight Show style. But and before we bring out one of your actors, let's look at a clip from Nebraska. This is near the beginning of the movie. In Billings.
Dad. Dad.
Leave me alone.
Come on, let me take you home.
I'm going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. I don't care what you people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad, I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
You can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome that boy, Orville Willis Forte the Fourth, Will Forte.
Thank you.
Why do you think Alexander hired you?
The term loser comes up again. I mean, I think in a way, you know, and not to demean myself, but there's something to that. There's I love myself. I don't think I'm a loser, but there's a connection I felt to the character. I don't know what it was. It's closer to who I am in real life than anything I've ever done. I mean, that's, you know, I do a bunch of absurd, crazy things usually, but it just felt, the good and the bad of the character felt more like who I am in my real life, and I could feel that, and I just assumed that he felt it too.
I did.
I can't believe I got to be in this movie.
I never thought I casted this guy in a million years, and I turned on his audition tape, and I just, from the get-go, I just believed you. I thought, oh, that dialogue feels right coming out of his head.
You were at Saturday Night Live for the better part of a decade. Did you decide, okay, I've played this hand long enough, now it's time to see what else I can do as an actor? What was the motivation?
Well, I had been there for 8 years. MacGruber had just come out.
You mean...
Thank you.
You mean the first MacGruber?
The first, yes. Where were you people when the movie was coming out? It had tremendously bombed at the theater. No, you know, in the box office, no pun intended. Over the summer, I thought, it just is time. It's been 8 years. My family's in California. It's a grueling schedule. I have OCD tendencies, so when I'm in there, I'm hyper-focused. You can't really do much else, or I couldn't do much else besides just work. So I just thought, you know what? I don't know what is out there for me. I certainly didn't think, oh, I got a, you know, movie career waiting for me. I just had bombed at another movie. I've been in a series of bombs. This is not a single solitary thing. So I just left thinking, you know, I'll see what else is out there. If there's anything, great. If not, I have something that I love very much to fall back on. I can go back to writing, and that was just the best fallback plan of all time. So I just left more for personal reasons.
How interesting, though, that, I mean, one could imagine, my God, I tried to do this movie, it didn't work. I'm going to cling like hell to this good job I've got.
It was hard to leave. I miss it still. It's the most unique job. There's nothing else like it. But it was hard.
So you spent 2 months in Norfolk, Nebraska last year.
Yeah.
No, that would be a laugh line. But did you learn anything about Nebraska, Norfolk, America that you hadn't known spending that 2 months there?
I mean, I learned that you don't have late night food options. That was a big deal. I loved it. I have not spent a lot of time in the heartland, and I've been in pretty major population centers most of my life, between growing up outside San Francisco, going to UCLA, and living in New York for SNL. So what an experience to get to come and live someplace for a while. You know, it's not, if you take a trip somewhere, you don't really get to experience it like a, not that I ever felt like a local, but you spend a couple months somewhere and you really get to learn what it's like, and it was an amazing experience.
Will Forte and Alexander Payne talking about the new movie Nebraska. I was speaking with them at an event for Film Streams in Omaha. In a minute, we'll be joined by the film star, Bruce Dern.
You got to get up pretty early in the morning to steal a scene from me.
Bruce Dern, plus the 84-year-old actress who does steal some scenes from him in Nebraska. Next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We are now going to continue with the conversation I had with Alexander Payne and the stars of his new film, Nebraska. Payne says that when he first read the screenplay for the film, he immediately thought of Bruce Dern for the role of Woody. It was the better part of a decade between that first reading and actually casting the film, but Payne got his wish and got what critics are calling the performance of a lifetime out of Dern. The actor joined us on stage at an event for Film Streams in Omaha, Nebraska, to talk about his 55-year-long career and his performance in the new film. Here's a clip from Nebraska in which Dern's character Woody is talking with his son Dave, played by Will Forte.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
Did you ever talk about having kids? Like how many you wanted and stuff like that?
Nope.
And why did you have us?
Because I like this. And your mother's a Catholic, so you figure it out.
So you and Mom never actually talked about whether you wanted kids or not?
Well, I figured if we kept on screwing, we'd end up with a couple of you.
We get all the jokes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Dern.
So, again, we're talking about, and this movie is about this not very loving or obviously loving household. It sounds like, from what I've read, you didn't grow up in a particularly loving household either. Was it any? It was well-to-do and grand, but did this give you, did your own upbringing give you some sense of how to play this guy?
Well, we had a house. It was big. It was filled with folks. There was my brother, sister, and I, and my mother and father. They smoked 4 or 5 packs of Chesterfields a day. They drank socially. You know, they get up in the morning, they have a highball, and they have lunch. And, no, they had a Bloody Mary. Then they had lunch, but before lunch, there were a couple of drinks. Then wine at lunch. The afternoon, they'd play golf, come in, play backgammon, have cocktails, have a dividend. Have wine at dinner. After dinner, they played backgammon, had a couple of whatever they were, and then a nightcap. Oh, boy. At the end, and yet, I never saw either one of them ever drunk in my life. I also never saw my father laugh and never shed a tear. He was kind of a stoic. And that's something that I took into the house in this movie when I did it. The hardest scene I've done in my career is when I go through the old house.
The house where you grew up in and is now a wreck. And
because I'm an actor who always starts from the inside out, and it's my inside that I start with. And the magical thing about it is that this man and Mr. Nelson, who wrote the material, give you lines that throughout your career you've generally had to make up yourself. I go in the house. We look into my room. I say, it's my room. She says, this is where Woody's little brother David died. He says, you remember that, Dad? And they give me a line that is so uniquely unusual to see on a page. Because the line is, I was there. I mean, you don't get that. And I've been doing this a long time. And
just in terms of the economy and the not trying to
not
make
so
a joke.
It's not so much the economy. It's the correctness of the verbiage.
For this guy. It's,
well, absolutely. And I had never thought about before in my entire career, I had never really had a role where everybody throughout the movie is talking about Woody. He said this happened. He said that happened. And even though it came some days by slow freight to me, and not fast enough for him, I got what he was talking about and where he was going. Don't show me anything. Let us find it. And he backed it up by taking the opportunity to watch behavior develop in the lens, scene after scene after scene. Well, you know, every now and then musicians say they get to work with great tunesmiths. Here's the master tunesmith.
And this is coming from a man who has worked twice with Alfred Hitchcock, with Ilya Kazan, with Chabrol, with Sidney Pollack, on and on and on. He's this guy, this guy we know from Omaha, is really in that league?
I would say on the basis of my entire career, Alexander Payne is probably the best director I ever worked for. Wow.
When before you became famous, you were in a whole bunch of movies that I think I saw in this city growing up in drive-ins. Biker movies, for instance. You did at least three of them. And
nine.
Really?
Well, if you throw in the acid movies, there's...
Yeah. Now, okay, so you begin with Hitchcock and Marnie and Ilya Kazan. Nine biker pictures. I mean, how did that happen? Just having to get work?
Well, it was a plus. It wasn't a minus. Because the whole group of us in front of the camera and behind got to work and go to the University of Roger Corman. You go to a set the very first day you work for Roger Corman. The three guys on the camera are Francis Coppola, Peter Bogdanovich, and Jonathan Demme. He knew how to pick people. He gave us a freedom to do this kind of stuff in really material. I mean, it was an advantage that helped me through a period of years where we weren't doing, all there was then was episodic television. There was no long form movies.
And you were on every show I watched as I looked. I mean, Sea Hunt, FBI.
I was lucky.
77 Sunsets.
I was lucky because if you did a Western and you died, you could do a Western every single year, that particular gunsmith, because they didn't have to bring you back and pay your residual.
As somebody who's been nominated for an Academy Award before, as we count down the days and weeks until comes out for this year, it must be hard not to think about that for you.
You know what? I know this sounds like BS, but it's fact. I didn't come to Hollywood to win awards. I came in to get better, to try and be, and I think Woody's about as close as I have come to being better, and I still have a ways to go. But the thing that I have always desired as an actor more than anything else was for all of you or a bunch of people, wherever they are, if they're going to make an all-star team at the end of the year, to just look at Bruce Dern and say, Bruce Dern could play.
Now, I want to ask you about the actress who plays your wife in this film, the June Squibb. Did she must have felt, given how few words, relatively few words, you had in the script, that she was stealing some scenes?
You got to get up pretty early in the morning to steal a scene from me. Number two, I resent the fact that people say she's stealing scenes. She was hired to do what she does. He realized and hoped there was a sense of flamboyance in her that could be the mother. And
well, let's watch a scene in which, whether she steals it or not, is certainly flamboyant, to use your word.
There's Woody's little sister, Rose. She was only 19 when she was killed in a car wreck near Wausau. What a whore. Huh. I like Rose, but my God, she was a slut. Huh. I'm just telling you the truth.
Where's your family?
Oh, they're over in the Catholic cemetery. Catholics wouldn't be caught dead around all these damn Lutherans. Here's Delmer, Woody's cousin. He was a drunk. One time we were wrestling and he felt me up. Grabbed a handful of boob and Woody was right there and didn't have a clue, did you, Woody?
So, why don't we welcome June Squibb? So Bruce was all humble about the Oscar talk. How about you? You thinking about getting nominated for an Oscar?
Well, I hope so. That would be the neatest thing in the world.
The character in Nebraska, Kate, is, I went through all the stories and reviews about it. I've never compiled a list of such negative adjectives and nouns about a woman. Shrewish, harridan. They get worse. Did you think of her as that as you were?
Never. I was born and brought up in Illinois, and I really felt when I read this script that I knew this woman. I knew who she was. I knew why she was doing what she was doing. And I always felt she loved him. I mean, there was never a question in my mind that she really loved Woody. And I really felt I knew her. And then after I saw the film, I thought, my God, that's my mother. And it really was. And she had two sisters that were crazy. And between the three of them, I think it was sort of in my genes.
And now you are also appearing in the HBO show Girls, mm-hmm, as Lena Dunham's grandmother. You are suddenly hot. Having turned 84 not long ago. Is this sort of, did this come out of the blue, the work you've been fortunate enough to have?
I don't know. These TV things had nothing to do with Nebraska. I don't think they even knew.
Really?
You know, no.
Do you just feel like you're just going to keep doing this until they stop asking you?
Sure. I mean, I never think of age. I really don't. I think it's, if you stop yourself by thinking of it, then that's ridiculous. And I'm healthy. I have no reason to turn down work. And I love to work. And I'm finding that as I get older, there's still work there. So
that makes me happy. Yeah. And are you someone also, as Bruce talked about and Will have talked about, I mean, does everybody here on this couch think, this is pretty much the best job I've ever had? Was this a good
Oh,
gig?
This was wonderful. Yeah, it was. The script, Alexander directing, I mean, it's you don't get that very often. So it was a joy from that respect.
And it is a joy for all of us. I want to thank June Squibb, Bruce Dern, Will Forte, and, of course, my friend Alexander Payne for being here today. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was from my conversation with June Squibb, Bruce Dern, Will Forte, and Alexander Payne, the stars and director of the new movie, Nebraska. It was recorded live in Omaha, Nebraska. The movie, Nebraska, is out now.
Omaha, you've been weighing heavy on my mind. Guess I never really left it all. I'm turning all those roads I walked around the other way. Coming back to you.
still ahead in this hour of Studio 360. An artist called his radical record The Shape of Jazz to Come. And voila, made it so.
It may be hard to imagine today, because today everything goes, anything goes. But back then it was a much different society. When you talk about going against the grain or going against the wave, you were going against a tidal wave.
Ornette Coleman's son and Sonny Rollins reflect on a jazz legend. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Around this time last year, we asked you for your creative New Year's resolutions. We wanted to know about the artful endeavors you've always been meaning to get around to and help you finally see them through. We spent the year nagging Charlie Kapp, who's now putting the finishing touches on his graphic epic poem, Linda Brewer, who's working on her final monthly short story for the year, and Ariel Lautman, who back in January said this.
My resolution has been to finally start using my power tools and do some woodworking for my home.
Ariel also sort of stumbled upon an entirely new creative project while she was building furniture for her house in Silver Spring, Maryland. Ariel, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi.
You started out almost a year ago with this resolution to make a bookshelf for your infant son, Ezra. How did that go?
It went really well. I made two shelves, and they both turned out really nicely. And then I moved on to some porch work.
Wow, that sounds a lot more ambitious. Were you much faster and more knowledgeable as a craftsperson on the porch?
I was. I also found that my tools were better suited for the large-scale projects. It was hard to get some of the exact measurements that I needed using the circular saw when I was doing the bookshelf project. I have since gotten a miter saw as well, so that helps.
A circular saw, which sounds frightening to me just even to think about. A miter saw, this has become a real thing for you, it sounds like.
Someday maybe I'll make myself a workshop.
Exactly. And what conventionally gender stereotypical girly thing will your husband do?
He does most of the cooking. I guess that's sort of stereotypical.
There you go. Early. Just as I did for the first 25 years of my marriage. And if only my wife had had a wood shop, life would have been even better. Did you get the porch work that you wanted to do done?
Well, I didn't get it all the way done because I ran into this second project that I think that you're referring to, which is that most of the summer I was laid up with exhaustion in the first trimester of pregnancy with our second child.
Well, congratulations on the second child.
Thank you.
Sounds like it worked out as well or maybe better than you'd anticipated.
Yeah, I think it did work out better because while I may not have finished as many projects, I certainly am proud of the work that I did, and I'm looking forward to continuing it next summer.
What's the next project going to be when you get around to hacking wood away again next summer?
I'd still like to do some work on the countertops in our kitchen and make like a breakfast bar. That's one of the projects that I had talked about for this year that I never got around to.
Keep in touch. When you finish those counters, send us some pictures.
Yeah. Thanks. I will.
Great. Ariel Lautman listens to Studio 360 on WAMU out of Washington, D.C. We tracked her woodworking progress all year long, which you can read about and see pictures of at studio360.org.
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
And with 2013 coming to a finish, we are once again going inside the National Recording Registry to find out what essential sounds have been newly preserved by the Library of Congress. This time, it's Ornette Coleman's 1959 record, The Shape of Jazz to Come. It was only Coleman's third album. He wasn't 30 years old yet, but it somehow managed to live up to the chutzpah of its title.
My name is Sonny Rollins. I'm a jazz saxophonist.
My name is John Littweiler. I wrote a book about Ornette Coleman.
I'm Donardo Coleman, and I am Ornette's son. Lonely Woman is a good example of my father's music. It's so melodic, and that's really what he concentrated on. There's so much melody in his playing. You're improvising, but it sounds like perhaps melody you've already written, but you're doing it instantaneously at that time. And, you know, it's powerful.
When you're improvising, listening to the other players, I think that's occurring on such a deep level of communication that it's almost impossible to describe. It's in the moment, it is unpredictable, and it's exciting. So Ornette does all of these things.
In 1959, when The Shape of Jazz to Come was recorded, was a very difficult year for jazz.
My man don't love me.
Billie Holiday died, Lester Young died, Sidney Bechet died. And then in a period of a little over a month, John Coltrane recorded Giant Steps, the Miles Davis Sextet recorded Kind of Blue, and Ornette Coleman recorded The Shape of Jazz to Come.
The jazz scene was divided into camps, so to speak. Dixieland style, swing style, but then also the bebop style. The chord structures of bebop were based upon the chord structures of swing, or the chord structures of Dixieland. It's the same songs, for instance, you could play I Want to Be Happy in Dixieland, you could play I Want to Be Happy in Bebop, and you're using the same harmonic structures.
But Ornette himself said that the first really free playing that he did was the album Shape of Jazz to Come.
Yeah, in 1959, when he made that record, things had not opened up. You know, it wasn't as if it was 10 years later and people were used to great change and thinking about change. At that point, in terms of jazz playing, things were dominated by really mastering playing on chord changes.
The controversy about The Shape of Jazz to Come had to do with Ornette's abandoning the harmonic patterns that jazz had been based on for the first half a century that jazz existed.
And that was a big break.
So he calls that concept harmelotics. And it's really where the melody and harmony and rhythm kind of have equal value and equal place.
I think he had worked out his approach a little more methodically, so it was more revolutionary in that sense.
You know, what's remarkable is I think at that time of Shape of Jazz to Come, my father was 29, and the other guys were, you know, a few years younger than him. So for him to be thinking totally outside and to execute it, it may be hard to imagine today because, you know, today everything goes, anything goes. But back then it was a much different society. And when you talk about going against the grain or going against the wave, you were going against a tidal wave.
Our Peabody Award-winning series on the National Recording Registry is produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich from BMP Audio. You can hear 20 more of these stories at studio360.org. From Donna Summer's I Feel Love to Vince Guaraldi's A Charlie Brown Christmas. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. But before we go, we want to invite you to join us at the Green Space in New York City on December 17th. They say there ain't no party like a Studio 360 party.
Say what?
Because a 360 party has 3D printers, or at least this one. You can learn how to print and design your own holiday ornaments with demos courtesy of MakerBot, and get drinks and hear live music from the electronic duo Javelin. Again, that's Tuesday, December 17th at the Green Space in New York City. Tickets are going fast at studio360.org/3D. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Special thanks this week to our friends in Omaha, Bob Cote of KIOS and Rachel Jacobson and the staff of Film Streams. And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
We asked the National Book Award-winning novelist James McBride to come in for an interview. He asked if he could bring his gospel quintet to play some songs. What were we going to say? No?
It's not my father, it's not my mother, but it's me, oh Lord.
James McBride, musician and author of The Good Lord Bird, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. It's not my